Good evening, everybody. Wonderful to see you. Even those of you who are on have stopped video and I only see your name. It's still nice to see you joining us. Very nice. Hope everybody's staying well. Everybody always wants to know, so what room are we in tonight? What room? What room are we going to?
You still in the kitchen?
Does anybody remember where we left off?
Kitchen.
And okay, what was the last thing we talked about?
Noah and the animals.
What?
Noah. We talked about Noah and the kosher animals. We were talking about all kosher.
Yeah, but what was the topic? Oh, you guys really pay close attention.
Food related to personality or something.
Okay, food. The fact is that we're sitting down to eat our meal. That's really what we're up to. Yeah. We've made the bread, right? We've made the bread and we took off the challah. We've washed our hands, netilas yodayim, and now we're ready to make hamotzi and partake of the meal.
Right.
What do you think is next?
Oh, the brachas.
Which bracha?
Benching.
At the end, the benching. Birkat hamazon, right? That's what's next. Wrong.
Eat the meal.
We're sitting at the table. We are far from done, ladies and gentlemen. We are far from done.
I have to start singing.
No, even before singing, listen to this. Many of you are aware that there is a law. There is a law in the Code of Jewish Law in the Shulchan Aruch that says that when we have a bread meal, we are to take that piece of bread and we are to dip it in salt. Familiar with this?
Yeah.
Putting salt on our challah.
Okay. I do that after I cut it.
What?
I do that after I cut it. I put the salt on the cutter, you know, the bread.
Great. Why?
Because of the sacrifice. It represents the, it has something to do with the sacrifice, doesn't it?
Something to do with the sacrifice.
Well, they use salt on the sacrifice.
Okay. I'll beg the question further. Why'd they put salt on the sacrifices?
Now you got me. I don't know.
That's not bad. One degree of separation. Not bad. Okay, so Fred, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. There is a law, and we'll talk about it in a moment. But here I want to start with the following. Picture the scene. Okay, picture the scene in the Tuchman household. We don't usually have only a few people at our table. Baruch Hashem, we love to entertain, and we have numerous people. So I like to go last washing, by the way. I like to be the last one. People think it's for religious reasons. Has nothing to do with it. I love quiet. So this way, everybody washes. Everybody has to be quiet, and I can keep talking, and nobody can respond. It's the best thing in the world. There is a basis for it in halacha, in Jewish law as well, because I'm the one that's making hamotzi. I want to minimize the time between my washing the hands, as we spoke about, and actually partaking of the bread. So... But what happened? Picture the scene. Let's take Muriel. You're the first one. You're like, okay, let's get the meal started. So you say, I'm going to wash my hands first. So you go ahead, go into the kitchen. You wash your hands, netilas yadayim, and you know, you make the bracha and you sit down at your seat and you're quiet. 15 seconds, 30 seconds, a minute. Meanwhile, everybody else is still washing. You know, there's numerous people here at my table. A minute and a half goes by, 2 minutes, 3 minutes. It's been a while. And you're like, if you're really in the, you know, you've been, no. You start, of course, not saying anything by saying things, right? That's how we do it, right? And you're like, listen to an unbelievable midrash. The midrash says that at that moment where people are sitting around their table waiting for the others to wash or before the one who makes hamotzi, there's that lag. Then the Satan prosecutes before God and says, oh, these people are sitting around and they're not doing any mitzvos. Shame on them. God, you should punish them. The Satan prosecutes at that moment and says they're sitting around and they're not doing anything productive. They're sitting there like a bump on a log and they're not accomplishing anything. Punish them. God holds up his hand, so to say, and says, don't worry. They have salt on the table. Okay. When I was growing up, when you hear something like that, it's called a non sequitur, right? It's called a, and you're like, no soap radio, right? You remember that? No soap radio? Anyone know what I'm talking about? It's a New York thing, whatever. Maybe it didn't get all the way to the place. It doesn't seem like, okay, he's prosecuting. It's a great argument and claim that he has. And what's the answer? Don't worry, there's salt on the table. What's that got to do with anything? So I want to share with you an amazing, amazing idea. And it will tie very much with what we spoke about last time about food in general. Let's take a step back. This is even before the Garden of Eden. I know. I'm even predating my favorite story. You have the 6 days of creation. So what happens on day two? We know on day one, it talks about that let there be light, but it also talks about that there's water. It says that God's presence hovered above the face of the earth, right, which was water. What happens on day two? God separates the upper waters and the lower waters. Does this sound vaguely familiar to anybody? Yes. Folks, it's chapter one, for goodness sakes. This is not like somewhere in Deuteronomy. Chapter one. God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters and let it separate between water and water. So God made the firmament and separated between the waters which were beneath the firmament, heavens, and the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. God called the firmament heaven, and there was evening, there was morning, a second day. Right, Arlene, you got me? Familiar, you knew this. Fine. So second day of creation, God separates the upper waters and the lower waters. Says the Midrash, the lower waters, symbolically, cried. They cried. And they said, it's not fair. Before you separated us, we were close to you. We were up in heaven together with you. Now you've separated and you've kept the upper waters towards yourself and you've cast us down below, down here onto earth. They cried, we're no longer in front of the king. God says, you're right. I will give you a covenant. I will make a covenant with you. And that is, on every single offering that is brought before me in the temple, I want you to bring salt. Salt. Where does salt come from? We know our earth science. Earth science tells us that you have water and it evaporates and it leaves salt crystals. How many of you have been to the Dead Sea? Yes, exactly. That is a super concentration of that concept. But it's not limited. Salt mines are evaporated water. So the salt that is brought on every single carbon, on every single offering that was brought in the temple, was symbolic of God saying, I'm going to bring the lower waters up back towards me. In the offering that is brought up to me, I want salt to be a part of it. Similarly, we'll talk about this another time, hopefully, but on the holiday of Sukkot, there's a special ceremony known as the water libation, where they poured water on the altar. Different discussion, but same concept, that every single time there is some service being done in the temple with a carbon, with an offering that's being brought, salt must be a part of it. So think about that. Water down here on earth is representative of the distance between God and us, right? Because God separated the upper waters and the lower waters. So the water itself represents what's down here. But salt is the symbol of connecting heaven and earth, of connecting that which comes from below, the water, which evaporates, and you have the salt, that is used in the service of connecting with God. So to say, joining heaven and earth. That's what salt represents. Okay? In fact, the terminology that the Midrash uses in this conversation is that God forged a covenant I use that word very specifically. The Midrash uses that word. What is a covenant? What is a covenant? Somebody tell me, what's a covenant?
An agreement.
Go ahead, say better.
Like a contract between two parties, that it's an agreement.
Ah, it's a contract that joins two different parties. Things, right, that are distance from each other, right? They're distance from each other. A covenant brings them together. Because this is what salt represents, the idea of joining heaven and earth together, that's why it's called a covenant. You with me? Okay. Now, we'll take it even further. I told you that this service was done primarily in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash. Why? Why specifically there? It could should be, make it that the salt, it should be every morning when we wash our hands, when we get up in the morning, we say, Moda Ani, we thank God for a new day. We wash our hand and we take salt and we throw it over our left shoulder. Then we throw it over our right shoulder and we go, Tui, Tui, Tui. We do all these things. Use salt in some kind of who knows what. Why specifically do we use it in the temple? So think about it. It's so fascinating. To appreciate it, we have to read a story in the Torah, though. A story that we just finished reading in our Torah readings of the week over the last couple of weeks with Joseph and his brothers. Remember Joseph? Yes, Joseph and his brothers. Finally, the fateful day comes. The brothers who had come down to collect food in front of and had to ask Joseph, they didn't know it was him. He accuses them of being spies. Because they tell a whole story that there were really 12 brothers. One is missing. One is very young. He's still at home, referring to Benjamin. Until Joseph says to him, you can take food now, but don't ever come back unless Benjamin is a part of this. So sure enough, fast forward, they run out of food. They got to come back down to Egypt. They convince their father they have to bring Benjamin down. So Benjamin and Joseph finally meet. And even after Joseph reveals himself, the Torah tells us that Joseph and Benjamin, in that fateful meeting, they hugged, they kissed, and the Torah says they cried on each other's fill in the blank. What? Muriel, what?
Shoulders.
Sharon?
Neck.
Muriel, that's what I expected the Torah to say. That they cried on each other's shoulders. No, the word the Torah uses is they cried on each other's necks. That's a weird place to be crying. You cry on somebody's shoulder. Even in English, that's what we say, right? Go ahead. You can cry on my shoulder. No, the Torah says neck. Why? But wait, it gets worse. Says Rashi's commentary on that verse. Why did they cry? You would think the simple answer is they haven't seen each other in 22 years. They miss each other. They're crying. Says Rashi from an early source, no. Benjamin was crying because the tabernacle, the Mishkan, that portable sanctuary that ultimately when we went into the land of Israel, the precursor to the temple itself, it ended up in Joseph's portion of the land in Shiloh. That's the name of the city. And it would get destroyed. It would get taken over by the Philistines. Benjamin is crying on the loss and destruction of this precursor to the temple that was in Joseph's portion, his territory. And Joseph's crying on Benjamin's neck because ultimately the temple itself, which was going to be built in Benjamin's territory of Jerusalem, that too was going to get destroyed. Rashi's telling us that they weren't crying because they were overcome with emotion of having not seen each other. They're crying about the temple. They're crying about the tabernacle. Really? If I wasn't a rabbi, I would definitely be a heretic. Like, seriously? This is what they're crying about in this story? There is no tabernacle after the story of Joseph and his brothers for... two hundred and something years. The temple is not built for another 500 years after that. So you mean to tell me this fateful meeting, they're crying about events that are hundreds of years away? That's what they're crying about? And even if you want to say, Rabbi, I believe every golden word you say because you're the rabbi. This is recorded, so you can't deny it. But even if that is true, ask me a good question and say, where did the sages get that from? There's no hint of this in the Torah itself. All it says is they cried on each other's necks. Whoop-de-doo. The answer comes down to this point, ladies and gentlemen. Why would the Torah call it their necks? Muriel's right. It should have said shoulders. Why use the word neck? So folks, what is the function of your neck? What does it do?
It holds your head to your body.
Yes, it does. It holds your head to the rest of your body. For people like me, that's a wonderful gift because I forget things. And no question that if it were not connected, I'd leave it somewhere. No question about it. But there's more to the neck. Liz is going to tell us what else is involved with the neck.
It connects your spiritual self to your physical self.
Really? Why do you say that? What's up here that's your spiritual self?
Your brain and your soul.
Okay. Thoughts. Thoughts are not real. Yes, they're what do you call them? Electrical impulses that are the brain, right? But the fact of the matter is it's not something you can touch, taste, hear, smell, or feel. It's like nothing. It's in there. Typically, we talk about the heart and the head being your spiritual side, connecting to the physical body. From the neck down, your torso and down is pretty much what we have in common with every other creature. Animals have this too. They have legs. They have arms. They don't call them, right? They're called four legs and hind legs. They have reproductive organs. They have things like we do. From the neck up is what separates us from the rest of the creatures. But it's more. What else is in your neck?
Your spine, or we already talked about that?
Your spine's not in your neck. I mean,
it runs up to your neck. All right. Throat, your throat, your
yeah,
your
go throat. Ahead.
Well, your larynx, your
your faculty of
talking.
Talking, yes. Speech.
Your faculty of speech is in your neck. Isn't that brilliant? God is such an unbelievable engineer and designer. It's purposely done this way because think about it. If these are my thoughts up here in my head, and use Liz's terminology, this represents my spiritual side. And the neck down below the neck is my physical. You know what the one faculty of mankind that is able to join the thoughts and the spiritual and the physical?
Speech.
It's our words. I have an ability, as do you, to share a thought that's in my head, convey it to you via words, and all of a sudden, you have a new concept in your head. How did that happen? It's an amazing design. And of all places, it's not in our fingers. Why? It could have been, you know, Shazam. You just, you shoot forth your thoughts through the fingers and your nails light up and boom, you have someone else on the other side who's a receiver and it's perfect. It's like a USB port. Just put it in. Wow, amazing. But that's not how it's done. It's done through the faculty of speech, and that's in your neck. Because the neck is the connector. That's what a neck is. It connects your head to your body, your spiritual side with your physical side. There's only one place on earth that is the perfect symbol of joining spiritual and physical. There's only one place on earth that is the epitome of joining these two, what seem to be diametrically opposing concepts, physicality and spirituality. And that's the temple. That's the tabernacle. The place where we connected to God, that's a spiritual concept. but we did it through physical activities. It's an amazing idea. So if you want to pick a symbol that represents the temple or the tabernacle, it's a neck. It's the ultimate connector of heaven and earth. Therefore, our sages, when they read the verse that says that Joseph and Benjamin cried on each other's necks, big alarms go off in their head and they say, whoa, that's not the normal term. Why would the Torah, why would God go ahead and use a funny expression about crying on necks? Oh, maybe there's a deeper meaning here. Maybe they were crying about that which is called the neck, that which is representative of the neck, the temple. And that's why our sages have that insight that Joseph and Benjamin, those are the only two tribes that had the tabernacle or the temple in their territory. And that's what they were crying over. This is a great insight of understanding why now salt, which is that connector of heaven and earth, was always used in the service in the temple, because that's the ultimate. But wait, there's more. Are we clear on this? I want to make sure that we're understanding. It's a fascinating concept.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
Isn't the crying on the neck an indication of more intimacy between them? It seems to be that if you cry on someone's neck, it's more intimate than if you cry on their shoulder. So isn't that an indication of their closeness, that they were true brothers?
I hear where you're coming from, but I'll ask you, if we had not had the conversation tonight, and I'm asking you to describe two people in the most intimate form who are crying with each other, how would you have phrased it? Would you have said cried on their neck?
No, but I could understand why that's like one step closer than what we would expect to cry.
Why? I'm asking you. I'm giving you free rein. You can design this and you can write it however you want. You can use whatever term you want. I would bet everything I have, which at this point is not much, especially God willing with a wedding coming up. But whatever I have, I'd be willing to bet you'd never come up with the phrase cried on each other's necks. You'd never come up with it. So why would, but, and even if I told it to you, you'd be like, that's a little weird. You wouldn't immediately say, oh, that's the expression that really captures the intimacy between the love. You wouldn't say that.
But I wouldn't necessarily say that it captures the spirituality.
Great, exactly. I'm with you 100%. I would never have come up with this on my own. Never. But I would have been left with a nagging question. Why use the term? There's crying in a million other places in the Torah. You don't find this expression of crying on the necks. It's so out of character and it's so unusual that it begs the question, there's got to be something more. You're right. You could say that it's an indication of the intimacy, the love between them. I'll buy that. But why the Torah records it that way? What would have been lost had it just simply said they cried bitterly in each other's arms? That's how I would have phrased it. Cried bitterly in each other's arms. I wouldn't have used neck. It's almost begging me to understand what's more, what's deeper about a neck. That's where it's coming from. Okay? But with that, maybe we can even understand something more. Many of you are familiar that on Shabbat or on a holiday, before we do the grace after meals, before we do benching, we sing a song, Shir Hamalos, right? We sing a song, Shir Hamalos B'Shabbat, whatever tune. There's a million different tunes out there, right? Most people, however, are not aware that there is a different psalm that is read on a weekday before the benching. You're like, really? Never heard of that. Go ahead, say it, Candy. Really? Never heard of it.
Never heard of it.
Right, exactly. That's why I'm here. Prior, if you open up in your art scroll, if you have it, right, on page 182, it's a split screen. right? I'll do it in English. You see, there's two paragraphs, one on the right, one on the left. Yeah, because on one it says Psalm 137, and then the other one says Psalm 126. The custom is you say 137 on a weekday and Psalm 126 on a Shabbat or holiday. Most people have no idea about the other Psalm. We know about the one for Shabbat, but not what's in it. I'm just going to read it to you. The custom to recite Psalm 137 in memory of the temple's destruction before grace after meals on weekdays. Here's what it reads. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat and also wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows within it, we hung our lyres, right? Musical instruments. There our captors requested words of song from us with our lyres playing joyous music. Sing for us from Zion's song. Sing for us from Zion's song. How can we sing the song of God upon the alien soil? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget it. Remember that line? Oh, if I forget thee, Jerusalem, let my right hand be cut off. That's where this comes from, by the way. Psalm 137. And we go through this whole story. Okay, this is the custom. But the opening line is so interesting. By the rivers of Babylon, why is that the one? Is because that was after the destruction of the first temple, right? That was done by the Babylonians, and we were taken as POWs into Babylonia. Okay, so by the rivers there we sat and also wept when we remembered Zion. The simple understanding of that verse is not only did we sit there, but we sat and we cried. Okay. And that is definitely the main basic understanding. However, if you read it a little differently, it's almost as if there we sat and we also cried, like there was somebody or something already crying, and we also cried. We joined them in crying. Who else was crying? Listen to a crazy understanding. I just got through telling you from the time of the second day of creation, upper waters, lower waters. Lower waters, what did they do when they were separated? What did they do? They cried. They felt distanced from God. So what did God do? He made a covenant. Don't worry. The lower waters, you'll still be connected to me, even in down there on earth. How? Because you'll have every single offering in the temple will have salt on it. So to say, you're still connected with me, right? You're connecting all the dots?
Yeah.
And now that the temple is destroyed, guess what? We're back to square one again. The lower waters are crying. Where's my connection? All along, I've been able to appease myself that I had the connection to you, God, even down here on earth, because I had salt. Salt was our connector. But now the temple is destroyed. We don't have offerings. Salt is no longer going to be that connector, that covenant that keeps me connected to you, God. So to say, we sat by the rivers of Babylon. You know who is crying? The waters. We came there on our way out of Israel, on our way down as POWs to Babylon. And we also cried, realizing what it is that we now have lost, that connection. We're crying together with the water that no longer have the temple, the ceremonies that connected heaven and earth. We too are distant now also without the temple. What a great insight. We also cried. Not we sat and we also cried. We sat and we also cried. You hear the emphasis on a different syllable? Instead of it being we also cried, it's we also cried together with the waters who now were crying that they lost their connection without salt, without the temple. If you're with me and I haven't totally lost you, now we can appreciate this law and this whole concept we started with. We started with Muriel sitting at the table. At this point, she's sitting there 36 minutes, and I still haven't made hamotzi.
You sure are slow.
And she's like, and I told you the midrash that says, that Satan says, they're sitting around and nobody's doing anything. God says, don't worry. You're protected. Why? Because there's salt on the table. What does that got to do with anything? Oh, now I understand, perhaps. This is our defense. We defend ourselves with the salt that's on the table. Because this is the symbol, the salt. Is acting as the symbol that no, our eating is not only physical, as Satan wants you to believe. They're just sitting there. They're going to fress. They're going to eat and fill their bellies. They're not doing anything in the service of God. Shame on them. No, salt on the table says, no, 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 you are wrong, Mr. Satan, or Rabbi Satan, or Reverend Satan, or Dr. Satan, or whatever it is you go by. You are wrong. Our actions here on earth can be elevated for a higher purpose, and I'm going to sit down and I'm going to have a meal, not just for my physical nourishment, but for my spiritual well-being too. I'm going to wash netilas yadayim. I'm going to make hamotzi. I'm going to say Torah at my table. I'm going to sing a song in honor of Shabbos. I'm going to bench afterwards. This meal is not about filling my belly. I can be elevated and connect from down here on earth. I can connect to up there in heaven together with God, connecting with God like salt and the lower waters. That's the declaration. And therefore, I'll get to you 1 second. And therefore, when I start my meal, the first thing I do when I get ready, I cut that challah and I immediately dip it in salt and say, right. This meal is not only about physics. It's all about connecting physical and spiritual. You like that, Sandy, huh? Yeah, I see that smile. Muriel, go ahead.
Does that this have anything to do with using salt to kosher meat? Is the significance of the salt also in that vein?
It might be. It very well might be. I think that there's also a very practical reason, and that is salt is an amazing extractor. Salt draws out the blood. It draws out flavor, right? That's why we put salt on food, because it extracts flavor, but it also extracts blood. There's a prohibition in the Torah. You're not allowed to eat blood. So salting the meat is allowing the blood to drain from the animal after it's been slaughtered. But it very well could be that that's part of the process, that the most physical thing, meat, I mean, it doesn't get more animalistic than that. We go ahead and we put salt on it. I'm using your idea. I haven't seen this in writing, but it makes sense. We put salt on it to remind us that it's not only about the physics. It's also using the food to connect for a higher purpose, connecting heaven and earth like salt. I'll buy that. I think that's a great idea.
Just really quickly, what's the procedural, like the trying to figure this, the way to do it? Basically, you're cutting the challah and then you just put the salt on it. I just want to make sure.
But there's different customs to do it. Right. But the bottom line is that just put some salt on that challah, whether it's actually dipping it, the salt on the table, or it has a special, you know, from a salt shaker. There's all different ways. The point being that before you eat, take a bite of the challah, there should be some salt put on it.
Okay, because you were saying dipping, and I wasn't sure what that was.
That's my custom. My custom is I pour the salt a little bit on the table itself,
mm-hmm.
and then when I cut the challah, I dip it in the salt, and then take a bite. That's how I do it.
But it could just be put on or whatever.
I've seen it that way as well.
Okay.
Go ahead, Chuck.
Okay. Does it have to be kosher salt?
Well, let me be careful here. It has to be kosher in the sense that it has a reliable kosher symbol, but not what we call in the store kosher salt, the coarse. It does not have, it could be table salt.
Okay.
So I want to be careful there. Yes, it needs to be kosher in the sense that it's not kosher,
yep.
but it doesn't need to be the coarse kosher salt. It could be table salt.
Okay, thank you.
Going on what she said,
that's probably the hardest question I've had all week. That was tough. So,
knowing what she said about putting it on the animals and draws that out, maybe that's why Hashem made it to draw the blood out, because to remind us of that.
Correct. Correct. I'm totally on board with that. Muriel, I think it's a great insight.
Thank you.
If we're good with this, then allow me, because we're friends and you're not going to get angry with me, you're going to hopefully allow me to take it even one step further. I'm going to skip the meal because we got to come back to that. And we're going to skip, at least for now, we're going to skip the benching part. But right before benching, right before grace after meals, here's another one that you got to, when you play Jewish Trivial Pursuit, you got to know this answer, because otherwise you're not going to get that slice of the wedge. You're not going to get that pie. Jewish customs and traditions. There is something called Mayim Achronim, the after waters. Some of you may have seen this in certain homes, is that when they say, okay, you know what, let's bench, it's time to bench, somebody brings out typically a small little thing of water. It's not meant to drink, and it's not meant to take, like you did before the meal of washing your whole wrist. It literally is just wiping your fingertips with water. Have you, any of you seen that?
Yeah.
Some of you have seen that. Okay. It's in many, many homes, they do that. It's called Mayim Achronim. The Talmud asks, what's up with that? It uses a much more, colloquial expression. This is Tachman talking, so it doesn't say what's up with that. It wants to know what's the rationale and what's the basis and the source and all of this. And what it says is as follows. In the olden days where food preparation and even the way we ate food was not necessarily the most hygienic. We ate with our fingers, not necessarily forks, knives, and spoons. And people didn't necessarily wash their hands. They got, they got their chicken grease all over their hands. There's something known as sodomite salt. Melach Sodomis is what it's called. Salt like or from Sodom. What exactly it is unclear. But the Talmud says that before we bench, after the meal, we need to wash away that sodomite salt. Why? Here's the terminology the Talmud uses. Because it blinds the eyes. On the simple understanding is that there was some, I'll use a chemical reaction, there's something that if the enzymes of that salt were put in your eye, it was dangerous. It could cause some level of blindness. And therefore, they felt after you finished your meal, wipe your hands. We think of it just as a napkin or, eat a nice greasy food. You got to wash your hands afterwards. So there must have been something in those days that was Melach Sodomis, the sodomite. So there was a physical danger. But there's got to be a deeper meaning. Customs like this and laws like this don't just, there's got to be something more. So listen to the following. I'm going to use the Hebrew, and then I'll translate and we'll talk about it. Three words, the Talmud says. Melach Mamon Chaser. The preservation, the salting of money, the salting of money is to diminish. Very much Talmudic expression, right? You're like, yeah, that's why I don't study that. Talmudic expression that says, Melach Mamon Chaser. The salting of money, you want to know how you can preserve your money? Chaser, diminish it. Okay. Raise your hands if you think that's counterintuitive. Right. Extremely counterintuitive. What do you mean? To preserve my money, it should be hold on to it. Put it in a mattress. Invest it. Do something, but don't give it away. Giving away, that doesn't preserve money. For those of you who have ever had the opportunity to give tzedakah, if you've ever had the opportunity to give away some of your money, not only do you feel good that you're making a difference in somebody's life, but you know what? Here's a dirty little secret. You didn't lose anything. In fact, you're going to gain. You say, Rabbi, you're good at a lot of things, but math may not be at the top of your list. Because if I have two and I give one away, Rabbi, I've only got one left. That's less, not more. So you're right. If you want to look at it strictly from a mathematician or a mathematical standpoint, but I got the spiritual X factor on my side, folks. And that is God made a deal. And God said, if you give away some of your money to help others, not only will I repay you what you gave, I'm going to increase and give you more, because clearly you recognize that you are a custodial of money and you know how to manage it well. You don't just hoard it and keep it for yourself, share it. Somebody like that, if you can share my money, God says, then I'm happy to give you more. And that's how it works. This is not the time or place, but I can tell you from both personal experience and from an organizational experience, it flipping works. Black on white. It just works. I have had many situations of where I don't know, how am I going to? And you know what? Sure, lo and behold, unexpectedly, something came in. Liz, you're only in the office a few years. Do we see this all the time? It's no joke. This is a Talmudic secret that people do not get. If you want to preserve your money, diminish it. Give some away. Not frivolously. Don't go gamble it in Atlantic City. That's not what it's talking about. Give it away for worthy causes. The problem is that in the city of Sodom, you know what? They had a totally different perspective. They had a perspective like you and I thought before we shared this Talmudic secret. And they thought the only way to preserve money is to keep it. And therefore, they had laws on the books. No guests, no strangers, no giving away. They were stingy. They were misers. What do you mean the evil? You know, we all know the story about Abraham was praying to save the city of Sodom. What was so terrible? The Torah says that they did evil in the eyes of God. Well, what'd they do? This is what they did. They were extremely stingy hoarders of their money. They were living in the most fertile area, which is why Lot went there. Abraham's nephew Lot went there because it was very fertile, great grazing. They made a boatload of money there. But can't have guests. In fact, what happened to Mrs. Lot?
She turned into a pillar of salt.
Thank you. She turned into a pillar of what?
Salt.
Yeah, now you know why. Because she didn't get it. She didn't understand this concept. You think this stuff is made up? Hollywood ain't got nothing on the Torah. They thought that the only way to preserve it is to keep it for yourself. Therefore, that kind of perspective is called sodomite salt. Sodomite salt is what it's called. The salt like Sodom's perspective. Putting a nice bow on this conversation tonight, one similarly can think that the only way to preserve our bodily strength is by eating and drinking. But no, the truth of the matter is that we need to minimize our physical pleasures. Yes, of course we need to eat. Of course we need to drink, but within moderation, not just because of our physical health, but for our spiritual health as well. It's not all about the physical pleasures of this world. They have a role. We need to utilize them. Use, not abuse. Therefore, at the end of a meal, we bring mayim achronim, we bring a little bit of water. Water, oh my gosh, separating heaven and earth. Oh my God. You know what we do? We wash away the sodomite salt perspective. We wash away that perspective that says, no, it's all about me. I'm going to hold on to all this, my possessions, my physicality, more and more and more. No. before the end of the meal, just like we started the meal with a perspective that said, I'm going to eat a meal that connects heaven and earth, not just about the physical. I end my meal with the same concept. And I wash away that perspective of it's all about the physical, hoarding it for yourself. We wash away that perspective of the sodomite salt, which blinds our eyes. Not necessarily, not limiting it to the physical danger, but how about the eyes of a perspective? It blinds our eyes. We don't see things the way they really are. We have been blinded to think that the only way to succeed in our world is to be in the rat race and to hoard more, get more. Even if it means stepping on somebody else, it's mine, mine, mine. No. Before we finish a meal, we take a little bit of water and we wash away that perspective that would, under other circumstances, blind our eyes. It also makes sense, finally, as opposed to when we talked about we washed our hands before the meal and we washed them. Do you remember, how do you hold up your hands procedurally, Robin?
It's
right. You lift upwards. The law is that when you do Mayim Achronim, this after water, the right before benching after the meal, after you get your fingertips wet, tilt them down. Specifically for this reason, the hands, which are all about me, my doing, my accomplishments, you know what? Turn it down, dude. Turn them down. It's not all about your hands. It's not all about you. It's not all about your physical. You de-emphasize the hands and realize the true strength comes from God. We start with washing our hands, preparing us mentally for what we're going to do at a meal. And we end the meal by washing so that we not be negatively affected by eating. And it's all about the physical. No, it's not. Physical eating is a means to spiritual growth. The two go hand in hand. You like that, pun intended? Finally, because I want to give you at least something about benching. I'm hoping that maybe next class we'll delve a little bit more into it. But let me give you any questions on this before I go further. Yes, Fred.
Can tzedakah be, in addition to it being money, if you give your, if you do something that in other words, can you productively give something to someone of your time if it benefits them at no cost? In other words, giving your time away. Does that count as tzedakah?
It doesn't count as tzedakah, but it does fall under the category of chesed, of kindness. You can't, the concept of giving tzedakah is monetary. I will say this.
Normally my time would charge someone for my time.
That's fine. That has a monetary value. That's true. That's true. But I would say like this. Someone once asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, of blessed memory, one of the greatest sages of the previous generation. Someone asked him about devoting time, volunteering, service. And his, after a lengthy discussion, his opinion was that not only are we supposed to give 10% of our money, 10% of actual finances, we should be devoting at least 10% of our time to help. Not in place of, but in addition to. It shouldn't be that I just write a check and I've done it, but I don't actually help somebody. He felt that you really need to do both. Actually give finances, again, each according to their means.
Yeah, I've known that the idea of giving tzedakah in money will bring back things to you also, but it just on a personal practical level, I recently I produced a video for someone. Normally they would have had to pay quite a bit for it. And I said, I'll do that for you. I knew she was not capable of, you know, it was something she needed, but strangely enough, a while later, a customer I hadn't heard of in 20 years called me to place an order with me. And
you're proving my point.
That's what I'm saying. It wasn't money that I gave, but what I gave was a value.
That's correct. That's correct. Remember these words, Fred. Melach mamon chaser. The preservative of money is the minchik. Give it away.
I have a question.
Give it away. Yeah. And there is a concept of service in kind. There's no question about that. Yes, Arlene.
Do we do this at every meal or just on Shabbos?
It's anytime you really have bread.
Okay.
Regardless of what day of the week. In a non-bread meal, it's already lowered its status. It's not called the same level of a meal.
Okay.
It's filling, and I got no problem, having a very hearty meal. But if it's lacking bread, even in the eyes of the world, it's not, you're missing the staple of life. It's not at the same level. So the rules are slightly different.
Was the question referring to the salt or to the washing of the fingertips?
The whole process.
Either one.
Oh, okay. So if you have bread in a meal, not even on Shabbat, because that's where you always would have it, but any other meal. In other words, if you had toast after breakfast, you would go through the same.
You have toast after breakfast or toast for breakfast?
After.
After?
Yeah, just the way I eat. But I'm giving up bread anyway, so for weight-wise. But basically.
Yes, so in that situation, yes, you should wash your hands in the Tehillas Yadayim before you eat it. And in theory, yes, you should wash your hands afterwards and then bench.
Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
How can they say you don't dry your hands when you dip them in the water? That's what I've heard.
Well, no. Don't dry them on your clothes.
Usually a napkin. Or something.
You can dry them. You're talking about, you may be confusing that with after you come back from a cemetery and you wash your hands. There we don't dry our hands. We let it air dry.
But no one up.
Another time, another place. Everybody's like, what? Okay, yeah. Put it on the...
I've been to many places where they do that and they just do the fingertips, but they don't dry them. They just rub them together like they don't physically dry them on something.
The problem is, from a practical standpoint, it's not that wet. So you just, you just wipe it on and you move on. But I don't think that there's any problem to dry them.
Okay.
Yeah, Alma.
What about... I always thought it was only the men who did it, not the women.
I'm sorry, you're not coming in clear. What? What? I can't hear you. What? I'll tell you this much. My mother-in-law, of blessed memory, was very particular to always wash my machronim. Always. She did it. Many, many, many women do it. I don't see a reason why not. Okay. I don't see why not. They have the same issues men do when it comes to this, this perspective or the danger or whatever. We're equals in this regard. I don't see why women shouldn't do it. My wife does not, by the way, just saying. She doesn't do it. Robin.
And the salt is just for the challah bread on Shabbat or no?
No, any bread meal.
Any bread meal, you have to do the salt?
You should, yeah.
If it's not challah even.
Challah is just a type of bread.
No, I understand. Like a bagel?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. If you go to Goldberg's, they have salt shakers. There's salt available.
All right. I did not know that. Okay. And it's anytime.
Hey, that's why I'm here. Okay. If you knew all this already, you wouldn't come. No. Listen, I sit in my basement every other day and I say, what can I tell them? What can I make up that they just don't know? That's my
goal. There's a lot.
All right, you know what? I'm going to pause it there. We'll talk, God willing, next week. Next week, we will talk about actually benching, the structure of it, the blessings of it, what's going on, because that's the next thing. So it's great. We made it through the kitchen somewhat, and we finally washed our hands. Muriel is excited because we finally ate the blasted meal, and we've even got our hands wet getting ready to bench. Now Rabbi G says we'll meet next week. Like the cliffhangers are just, it's brutal. I know.
Do we drink wine at the beginning or do we have to drink?
What else? Any other questions? All right. Fabulous. All right. I'm going to actually let you out on time today. Amazing.
Amazing.
I haven't done this in years.
As Rabbi Cosmo would say, amazing.
Amazing. I just want you to know I'm not done. I'm up to number three where it says grace after meals, talk about the structure progression. I'm like, all right, we'll save it for next week. I know where I'll start next week. All right. Have a wonderful rest of the week.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Sorry if I was
Bye, buddy.
I have strep throat, so.